Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters, that's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. picoshouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretend she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Taja Chavelle on the show with me today. Taja has a brand new book. It's been out for a few months now, but it's called From the Root, A Memoir and a Philosophy for Balance in Our World. Welcome to the show, Taja.
Thank you so much for having me, Hank. I really appreciate it.
I'm excited to have you. Taja, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Wow. Well, you know, my first memory of wanting to write a book is when I was in fifth grade. My parents had taken my sister and I out of school, and they were homeschooling us in a 16 by 16 foot cabin in the middle of the woods with no running water, no electricity, and you could not get there by car. You could only get there by boat, snowmobile, or airplane. And it was a really wonderful, magical, impactful year for our family and for me. And during that year, I remember learning about trees and learning about how you could count the rings of the trees and you could find out how many years they lived and if they had experienced hardship, et cetera. And I decided that I wanted to write a book about trees. So I started to do that. I didn't finish it, but that was my very first memory of wanting to write a book. I had written stories prior to that, but that was the first time that it occurred to me that I could write a book.
That's fantastic. I have so many questions I would love to ask you about that. But did you see it at the time for the gift that it was? You know, sometimes a lot of kids can't. These are things you learn to appreciate later in life when you look back on it. You know, a lot of kids would be like, "We're going to do what?" And you know, when you were in the midst of that experience, living, you know, in the woods. Did you appreciate it for what it was at the time?
Yes, I did. And, you know, we loved it. We looked forward to it and it was great. We loved every minute of it. So it wasn't one of those things where I look back and say, oh, I wish I had appreciated it more. I've appreciated it, you know, all my life, including during the time that we were there. And I touch on that a little bit in my book, that experience, just to sort of let readers know where I've come from, what I've been through, and what inspired me to write this book, From the Root.
Well, you know, and you would think if you picked up your book and started kind of digging into your philosophy and the subject matter you've taken on, you would think, well, Taja has been, you know, a horticulturalist or, you know, has worked in forestry or something all this time, but you have had a very interesting path that's brought you to where you are now. What has been your career path?
Well, you know, when I was after we lived in the woods for a year, because I was born and raised in the city, we went back down to our house in the city. We lived there for a year, and then my father and mother bought a farm, and I lived on the farm for 3.5 years. And I went on from there. I went to a boarding school, and I ended up graduating ahead of my class. And then I went into music. So I was born and raised in Minneapolis, and at the time, Prince was a rising star, and I started to perform in various bands. At one point I was in 5 different bands. I was in jazz bands and R&B bands, straight ahead jazz, you know, fusion jazz, funk bands. And then I started my own band. And I also worked at a radio station called KMOJ in Minneapolis. And one thing led to another. And I was accepted. I actually was also trying to go to the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And in the same week that I was accepted into the Berklee College of Music, Prince offered me a record deal. And normally that would be, you know, it wasn't much of a decision. I mean, I knew right away that I wanted to take the record deal. But I did tell Prince I would wait for 24 hours to make my decision, but I had already made up my mind as soon as he offered.
Prince is an icon, especially people of our generation. I don't remember, a momentous life event that didn't have some Prince, in the background somewhere. That had to be mind-blowing.
It was mind blowing, and it was just fantastic. And you know, I was basically ushered into Hollywood on a sort of A-list red carpet from that point on. So my experiences up until that point, you know, I had been born and raised in a city, had lived in the middle of the wilderness, had lived on a farm, and then was flown to Hollywood on this red carpet and started having these all these other, you know, experiences in the music business. And that's been my life until I started to record a CD for Sony Records several years later in Detroit, Michigan. And during that time, the more time that I spent in Detroit, the more I became acquainted with the severe job loss and poverty that the city was experiencing, jobs being shipped overseas, et cetera. And also I saw an undue amount of unused land in the city, 17,000 acres of unused land at the time. I had just never seen anything like that in a city. And so I, just pulling from my experiences on the farm, I looked at that land and said, wow, why don't we plant food on that land? Because you know, fallow land used to be looked at as an opportunity for planting food if you're hungry. So I put my music career on the back burner and I started a charity called Urban Farming. And I started it with three gardens, community gardens of free food that people could pick 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without anybody monitoring them. And, you know, and $5,000. It was real grassroots, and it grew within 4.5 years into really creating a global trend for community gardening all around the world. And now we have over 66,000 gardens around the world that are all a part of the urban farming global food chain. And so this is what brought me to writing this book. This book is not about gardening, as you mentioned. It's called From the Root, a Memoir and a Philosophy for Balance in Our World. And it really came out of all of these different experiences, me experiencing a gap, a bridge, a gap that needs to be bridged, a gap of misunderstanding between different people, whether they're affluent or they're scraping and scratching, whether they're from different backgrounds, different religions, different races, different genders, different ages. That I have just seen such gaps of misunderstandings between people, but I have experienced that, you know, within this spectrum, I have so many different friends, and they're all so much more alike than they think they are. So that was one of the things that really propelled me and inspired me to write this book about bringing our communities into balance around the world.
When when you were pursuing your music career and going to Hollywood and all of the amazing things that you have gotten to do, were your parents still living on that farm?
They were for a little while, but you know, they eventually moved back down to Minneapolis. And farming was something that my father loved. And I'm so happy that he did. And I'm so happy that my parents were bold enough to homeschool us that year in the middle of the woods, I mean, where the temperatures would frequently be at like 40 below zero. So, you know, that pioneering spirit that they had and that their parents had really runs through me, and a love for the land, a love for for nature and the environment and plants and just a knowledge of what hard work is and what it's like to work on a farm. And all of those things were things that eventually I was able to draw from when I started urban farming. And so just a culmination of life experiences, and just very, very thankful that my parents are who they are. Because if they weren't who they are, then I wouldn't have been able to have all these experiences to draw from, and also just the inspiration and belief in myself that I can do it, even to go into music, which was something radically different from what they thought I was going to do. Because I originally wanted to be a botanist. So.
Well, what's interesting, I grew up on a farm that was really no longer a working farm. We always had a garden for, we would have fresh vegetables in the summer and all that. But my grandparents who'd lived there before us, for several generations, this was, a working farm for survival. And, growing up in that atmosphere and around, those types of people and understanding that you can cultivate and you can take care of this thing, this earth that we have, and it will feed you. And there's a special relationship there, and people can pursue all sorts of hobbies and different interests, and then people may move on to other interests. But if you ever understand the process and see how the world works, it's something you can never, you may move on and do different things, but it's something that will always be ingrained inside you want it.
That's true. I really agree with that. And, I think what's interesting is in the beginning, even though the charity is called Urban Farming, we worked in rural areas and suburban areas and urban areas. But in particular, in the urban areas, it was great to see something brought to many of the people, and especially the students and young people who had never seen anything like this before because they live in a city. So we had I remember, I mean, I have scores of these stories, and many of them I tell in the book, but one of them was a 17-year-old student who was on a garden, and she was in the city, and she saw an eggplant, and she asked her teacher, "What is that?" And the teacher said, "That's an eggplant." And so she exclaimed excitedly, "Oh wow, is that where eggs come from?" And and what's great about it is, first of all, if I didn't know, that's what I would think. And so, and secondly, it was just such a teachable moment. It was a great teachable moment. And we had many, many situations like that with students and people from the city who had never had a chance to be out on a farm, or really didn't, were so disconnected from where the food comes from. So having those teachable moments, that really gets into sort of the crux of what I talk about in this book, about bridging gaps and bringing people together. Because oftentimes I've found that just having conversations and getting to know people is what people need to bring them together. And in this book, I illustrate through some of the economic arguments that I put forth in the book. I illustrate how our societies are so out of balance, and in the need to be brought, have such a need to be brought back into balance, just through some of the economics. Like in the United States alone, we're wasting over $6.2 trillion every single year. And so some of those areas I pinpoint in the book. Some of those areas are, if we just had healthier diets, we'd save $71 billion. Cut down on the cost of crime. Crime is costing the United States alone up to $3.4 trillion every single year. These are things that people don't normally think of, and these are things that I've started to learn about as I've been through, in my boots on the ground experiences. I mean, even there was a study out of Iowa State University that revealed that one single murder costs society $17.25 million in indirect and direct costs. So bringing that story to life, bringing those, facts and figures to life, those indirect and direct costs are costs that people normally would never think about. You know, the costs of the investigative costs, the hospitalization, the insurance costs, the loss of life to the family, et cetera, et cetera. And telling those narratives, telling those stories so that people can really see how out of balance we are. When we bring ourselves back in balance, we can recapture and reallocate that wasted capital, and we can reallocate it right back into our communities and build up and strengthen our communities. And the more we come into balance, the more we're able to do that. So I put solutions out, but I also have a lot of stories, draw from my experiences and tell stories about what I've witnessed and what I've experienced, and along with all of the research that I've done for the book. So I'm excited about this book. I'm excited about the tales and that it tells, and the information that I'm putting forth in the book.
Well, excuse me. That's one thing that I really love about this book is it's not just you telling us kind of your view on how to fix the world. This is the things you've come to because of the journey that you've been on and the people that you've experienced and excuse me, my voice trying to leave. And the kind of the practical solutions that you've come upon. Take me back, if you will, to Detroit, when you were there and you started realizing, all of the waste around you and waste in, underutilized land, and just resources that were just letting sit there and rot. Walk me through, if you will, what was going on in your mind when you had this sort of epiphany. You know what? I see a problem here, and I think I might have a solution to at least part of that. What was that like?
So that's a really great question because it unfolded through time, but originally it was sort of an epiphany. Oh, we can do this. Let's plant food on this land, make the food free so that whether you worked on the garden or not, you can come and get this food. You can come and get it at midnight, which is really what touched people's hearts about these gardens. That was one of the hallmarks of it. But I started to learn that, okay, it's costing, the city of Detroit $800,000 to mow this unused land. So if we put this land to use, it's a win-win-win-win. We cut down on the cost for the city of mowing the land. We cut down on the crime because there are crimes that take place and waste high grass. We cut down on the pollution. We cut down on hunger. Where people, once they have that problem of how am I going to feed my family, taken off of their plate. They be, now they're able to tackle some of the other issues that they're dealing with, so they become more productive. And this was the same case with cities all around the United States. I mean, we one of the things that I talk about in the book is high bonds, human infrastructure bonds, which strengthen the human infrastructure of our communities, much in the same way that we do with roads and bridges. We have municipal bonds for roads and bridges and schools, et cetera. What about the human infrastructure? So when we are able to create investment opportunities with public and private partnerships, and we can create those investment opportunities for people, we don't have to look to those antiquated and default positions of cutting federal budgets and raising taxes, because now we're creating investment opportunities that are also a win-win for the investor and for the community. And we raise the community up, we create a level of abundance that we've never seen. And one of the things that sort of sparked this idea for me is that we entered into, with Urban Farming, with the charity Urban Farming, we entered into a public and private, it's sort of a partnership, even though we weren't legally partners, but we entered into a project with Kraft Foods and the Triscuit cracker. And we planted 21 community gardens in 65, I'm sorry, 65 community gardens in 21 states around the country. And we were on the Ellen show, and they put us on the back of 28 million boxes of the Triscuit cracker. Ellen put a garden on the set of her show and promoted this project all summer. And what it did was it really created sort of a Jenga moment for community gardeners around the world. And what it told me is how powerful public and private partnerships are. And so when you have coexistence investing in public and private partnerships coming together to invest in high bonds, to strengthen the human capital, the human infrastructure of our communities, that's when our world will start to see a major level of abundance that we've never seen. And when you think about it, the Institute for the Economics of Peace did a study, and they found that if we had just been 25% more peaceful in the year 2010, the world economy would have reaped an additional $2 trillion. So the economics of peace, it's a real thing, and the economics of peace are far more abundant than the economics of warfare and domination structures. So moving us in, balanced positions where we create abundance everywhere, that's what we want, because that's when we're not scraping and scratching to feed our families. We have real joy and real quality of life.
You talk about this kind of whole life philosophy, and we're talking about more than just growing food. You're talking about the economics of peace. And you mentioned earlier the cost to society that one murder costs society, you know, and we're talking about more than just the loss of that family who loses a loved one. There's also an economic cost that we all pay for that. And I think we can all agree that the less of that we have, the better we all are. But what can we do that makes that a reality? How can we actually reduce those violent crimes and murder and all that? And does this whole philosophy, do all of the pieces work together? Like if we create more opportunities for people, if we show them how to be self-sufficient, do those things equate more peaceful people that then don't promote violent crime? Like how does one affect the other?
So through my experiences and my research, what I found is that, you know, we have seven fundamental principles that we talk about with urban farming. I talk about them in this book. And those seven fundamental principles are really what is needed in a healthy, balanced society. So bringing balance, again, is the whole idea here. Just like in a garden, you want to make sure you're not overwatering, underwatering, et cetera. You want to make sure that your societies are in balance. So there are many, many ways that we can do this. And the seven fundamental root principles that I talk about are specifically the areas that would be invested in with high bonds and human infrastructure bonds. And those are healthy thinking, healthy communication, healthy eating, healthy fitness, healthy finances, healthy education, and healthy families. And when all of those areas are brought into balance, we see less crime, we see less obesity, we see the educational achievement gaps in our country, you know, closed. We see less mental illness. And so those are the areas that when they're brought into balance, we can recapture and reallocate the wasted capital and reinvest it back into our communities. And so really it's a campaign to heal our world from the root. And when I say from the root, if we don't get to the root of the problems that we're dealing with, then we just keep slapping Band-Aids on them and keep rolling. But the problems get bigger and bigger. And so, you know, we have issues that really need to be dealt with in our relationships with each other. And one of the things that I'm really, really keen on right now is healthy communication. I've done some studying in this area. And I'll just say this for anybody who thinks it's a namby-pamby subject. If you're invested in anything, if you have a trust fund or you're invested in any company, you might want to know that according to a Towers-Watson study, companies that have healthy communicators as leaders pass on 47% higher earnings to their shareholders over a 5-year period. So the reason that I keep bringing up economic arguments Because certainly in the book, I also bring up spiritual, medical, scientific, quantum physics, different arguments from different standpoints. But I think that the economic arguments are really important because if we can show that the economics of being in balance and having peace and healing our world from the root are far greater than the economics of war and fighting and speaking mean words and unkind words to each other, that hopefully is a big motivating factor. For people to take a good look at it. Because, hey, if you're invested in a company that doesn't care about healthy communication, you're literally losing money as I speak.
Exactly. Taji, you have been an artist for quite a while, and you have been a storyteller, both as a recording artist and a songwriter. When it came time to tackle this project, do you feel like that your time that you've spent before in songwriting, performing, communicating with people, do you think that that has helped or played into the creation of this book, and do you think that was good preparation time for the kind of storytelling you're doing now?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. I mean, one of the first things that, I'll just say a lot of thoughts going through my head about that. But one of the first things that I learned when I signed with Prince and I worked closely with Warner Brothers is, they immediately took me through media training. So I learned how to do interviews. I've been doing interviews my whole life almost. That is a very important element to being able to take an idea and talk to people about it and put it forth in a clear and concise way. Also, songwriting. So I would always challenge myself with songwriting. I've worked and talked to Prince. I've worked with Prince, Burt Bacharach, Tom Bell. They're all just amazing artists, legendary artists. And the art of putting an idea forth within a song where you have to do it creatively, you don't have a lot of words, you don't have a lot of time. You have to learn how to do that. And that really helped me before I started writing my first book. My first book is still unpublished. It's a novel. It's finished, but it's unpublished. It's called Rain on a River. But I noticed when I was writing that book that the art of songwriting really helped me to put my ideas out on paper in a clear and concise way.
The book is From the Root, a memoir and a philosophy for balance in our world. I love the concept of getting to the root of the problem, Taja. Someone could have a headache, and we could just keep taking, ibuprofen or Tylenol every day to treat the symptoms. But if we don't know that there's a brain tumor in there causing those, not only are we not going to solve the problem, but we're going to allow the problem to just get worse and worse and worse. So, I love the philosophy, of, we all can point our fingers at all the things that are wrong with the world, but how do we get to the root of it? And how do we each, make a contribution to change? Because it really is what, while it's important for us to, elect officials that can handle, the government business that we believe in on our behalf. But, sometimes it also means getting your hands dirty and getting your boots a little dirty.
Yeah, and I would say this, if you're planning to cast a vote in the 2020 election, make sure the candidate of your choice is actively healing our world from the root. And I'll just say this as well. I've had many hours of conversations with Prince. Prince was very adamant about doing things to help our world. And one of the things we talked about was the power of our lyrics. And Prince came to a point in his life where he really understood that every form of art that he puts out there is having an effect on our world. And I've done some studying in this area too. I mean, there are studies out of Harvard that and different places that show that when you speak kind words to somebody, you're actually enhancing your own immune system and you're enhancing the immune system of the person that you spoke the kind words to, and vice versa. If you're speaking unkind words to somebody, you just denigrated your own immune system. You've just damaged it. And you've damaged the immune system of the person that you spoke the words to. So when we start getting into this kind of, when we we start to learn more and more about how we're affecting the world, then we can become more mindful and we can understand that, hey, we all want a happy place to live. So let's heal from the root. Let's do what we can from our own position. And the book really gives a lot of solutions and easy things that people can do. And that's what it's all about. You know, it's all about healing our world from the root.
Well, and as writers or lovers of books, I hope that we all understand that words matter and
That's
the kinds of words we use matter. Taja, this has been so much fun chatting. The new book, From the Root, A Memoir and a Philosophy for Balance in Our World, is out everywhere now. If you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, the book is in Kindle Unlimited, so you can read it that way, as well as a Kindle edition and paperback. Taja, please tell folks where they can connect with you online if they're just learning about you and all the great stuff that you're doing.
great. Well, thank you. The book is available on Amazon, and you can connect to me and find out more about it, tajasavelle.com. And I'm sure that you'll be able to see that on Hank's website as well. But tajasavelle.com will keep you posted on new books, new speaking engagements, and new music.
Excellent. We're going to put links to all of your stuff in the show notes of this episode and to From the Root, where you can buy your copy. Taja, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show
Well,
today.
thank you so much for having me. I really had a great time and I appreciate it.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Jason ate Thanksgiving dinner alone at the Horseman restaurant. He had the place to himself. Everyone else had somewhere to be. He picked at his burger and fries, thinking of meals past. Thanksgiving had always been Eliza's favorite holiday, as Halloween had always been his. Jason glanced at the menu propped at his elbow. The horseman with his hand held high, carrying a tray with burgers and a shake. The horseman he'd seen on Halloween was no cartoon. That horseman was a thing of crematorium ash, of grave clothes and withered grass, riding a horse of autumn leaves and snail shells and pieces of skull. Jason's hand rose to the tender stripe of skin on his neck. The hatchet cut. "You okay, honey?" Jennifer, the waitress, appeared at his elbow. She had dyed her hair since he'd first met her. A pink stripe ran through the gray now, as if she had stuck her head in a cotton candy machine. "Yeah, I'm full." She raised an eyebrow. "That bad, huh?" Jason glanced at his plate, still piled with food. "Just not hungry." "You know, I saw the headless horseman once," said Jennifer, refreshing Jason's cup. She glanced about, deciding something. She set the pot down on a nearby table and slid into Jason's booth with some difficulty, sucking her belly in. "I've seen him," she whispered. "Just like you." "When?" "Oh, 10 years ago." Jason glanced around to see if the cooks or busboys were watching, to see if she was playing a prank. "Where?" he asked, trying to sound casual. "East of here. Sam and I used to live out on Sawmill River Road. I worked at my daddy's Applebee's franchise, you know. It's still there. Daddy sold it, though. It was around Halloween time, and I was coming off shift. It had been a night, believe me. Parties of like 20. We sang to the little brats, 'Happy, happy birthday from all of us at Applebee's.' The horseman?" "Right." She produced cigarettes. "Do you mind?" Jason shook his head. "Thanks. Don't tell the smoke police." Jason slid the saucer from beneath his coffee mug to serve as an ashtray. "It was about midnight, probably. I counted my tips. And those little bastards stiff you, by the by. So I wasn't in a good mood. I was waiting for Sam to pick me up. I was smoking in the parking lot, trying not to catch my hair on fire, and I heard this thunder coming down the Pocantico Hills from the direction of the hollow. Rumble, rumble, rumble. But it was clear out, and the sound got closer and closer. We had a full moon that night, hanging over the top of the ridge, and I saw him come up the other side, this black shape on a horse. Fast as the devil, late for church. He was down the hill before I knew it, coming right at me, and he jumped Sawmill River. Kaboom! And when he reached the parking lot, I saw." She drew one finger across her neck. Nothing. No head. And it wasn't any real horse, either. Too damn fast. He was in a hurry. Didn't even see me. Whoosh! My apron blew up. The dumpster started rolling. Car alarms. Blew out my damn cigarette. He shot across the field. Beeline, due east. Never saw anything like it. So... She patted Jason's hand. I know you're getting laughed at. But not by me. She stubbed her cigarette in the saucer. Some of us believe you.